Down to Eric.
Live from Washington, it's the Inside Scoop, with all the news the government does not want you to know. Now, here's the host of the Inside Scoop, Congressional Attorney Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. In the most recent debate between Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, a surprising issue came up. Oh, I think we all expected the 60-minute disquisition on health care. It's one of the few things that differentiates Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But what may have surprised a few is how much they talked about NAFTA. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the agreement passed in the 1990s, a treaty, as it were, between the United States and Canada and Mexico that regulates trade among them. As a free trade agreement, basically what it does is it gets rid of barriers to trade and allows goods to trade interchangeably between Canada and Mexico. It's one of the main things that Bill Clinton was proud of. Hillary Clinton, however, didn't share her husband's affection for NAFTA. Bill Clinton has said that he needed to regulate and change some of parts of it, namely the labor aspects and environmental aspects. But what is the role of these free trade agreements? Do they help the economy or harm the economy? A number of folks who recognize Hillary Clinton's big wins in Ohio and squeaker in Texas say that it may have been trade issues that played a role. Now, any economist will tell you that free trade, all things being equal, is good for an economy. If I happen to make pieces of art better than you do, and you happen to make wheat better than I do, it makes sense for me to buy my wheat from you and you to get your art from me. Otherwise, you'll be stuck with bad art, and hey, I'll go hungry. I mean, free trade is part of basic economics, part of capitalism. And yet, protectionism runs very strong in America, and it has its points. After all, in Mexico, wages are far, far lower than in the United States. You want to know why so many immigrants are coming here? Well, because their wages in Mexico are very low. So if you have a product that's made by people making 50 cents an hour, or a dollar an hour, or way less than our minimum wage, is it fair to allow that product to compete fairly with American products? Now, some people will say labor is just like anything else. Some labor is just like the fact that you can grow sugarcane in southern areas, and you can grow other crops in different areas, and America is good at service industries and computers, perhaps. While even today, steel companies are going to third world nations where you can indeed get steel cheaper these days. But the question is, I think, what should be the role of the United States in trade policy? Should we have free trade between Canada and Mexico? Maybe Canada at least, right? I mean, Canada has wages close to ours. It has a social network that's more advanced than ours. Shouldn't we be trading freely with Canada? And what should be the role of the U.S. government in facilitating these trade agreements? My guest today, Dr. Gabriela Lemus, is the director of the Latin American Labor Group, and she's concerned about something that's going on in secret or without much press. It's the development of something called the North American Competitiveness Council. And the North American Competitive Council is an organization, and she'll tell us about it, involving the governments of Canada, Mexico, and the United States, and some of our major corporations in all three countries. And they are banding together to increase competitiveness. Now, does this help capitalism, or does it harm it? We have in the United States antitrust laws. And the purpose of antitrust laws is to prevent major corporations from coming together to do things like setting prices. One of the things that makes capitalism work is when you have different corporations able to compete with each other on a fair basis. But if they're all setting the same price, they're not competing very well. Does the North American Competitiveness Council violate antitrust laws? Or to make things more simple, in Ross Perot terms, is that giant sucking sound that we're hearing, all our United States corporations going south. In Ohio and in Michigan, the voters may have thought so. These are states that went to Hillary Clinton, and in Ohio, there are a lot of very tough times for working class families. This is a state that's been hit very hard by the recession that's going on. And it's a state that really has had, let's just say, its share of labor issues. So what is the role of the NACC? What is the role of the government? And what should it be? Do you believe, as an economist, that we should have free trade, that it's okay, that if other countries have cheaper labor rights, that's just what they're better at, and we're better at other things? Do you think that tariffs harm the economy? Or do you think that this can go too far? Democratic voters seem to feel that issues of economics and NAFTA do matter, and that we need more protectionism. Indeed, one of the things that I think harmed Senator Barack Obama's campaign recently in Ohio was the idea that his economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, was talking with the Canadians and telling them, in effect, that he's really not going to change NAFTA all that much. It's a tough issue. It's a complicated issue because it's one that goes on two very core principles. One is fairness, the idea that you want to have labor rights, you want to compete fairly, you don't want to have your products where you have your laborers treated well with health care and protection against safety issues and so forth, competing against a country like Mexico where they don't have those high wages, where they don't have safety issues. You also don't want our workers competing against a country that doesn't care about the environment, because, let's face it, sometimes it's cheaper to pollute than to not pollute. On the other hand, it can go too far. If you have too much protectionism, if you have too many tariffs, if you slow down trade between nations, it ends up where we have to make everything in the United States. And that's not good. We don't make sugar as cheaply as a Caribbean nation. We don't make steel as cheaply as some other nations. So trade is of a benefit. What's the fine line between them, and what is the role of the North American Competitiveness Council and all of that? We will explore these issues. But I want to encourage you to call in if you have a comment on this subject. It's easy to do. The number is 571-749-1166, toll-free, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back with more of The Inside Scoop right after this.
How far would you go to help someone? Would you go to the end of your driveway? Would you cross a street? Would you cross an ocean? To a place 6,000 miles from home? How long would you go? Would you go for a week? A month? A year? Would you go for 2 years? Would you go if you could use your knowledge to teach someone? And in the process, maybe learn something yourself. Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps.
James, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not your helmet.
Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
Monica and her friends want you to know that you should never get near a dog when it is eating, playing with a favorite toy, or sleeping. It's really important to make time for exercise and games and keep your dog's vaccines up to date. Never leave a dog in a small, confined space. This can make dogs aggressive like Monica. If you follow this advice, you and your dog can play safely and happily together.
Thank you. go to jail for a gun crime, and your family serves a sentence with you.
I'm Bob Costas, and I've been broadcasting sports for a long time. Much of what I do is ad-libbed, but still, one of the most important aspects of my job is being able to write. Narrations, essays, commentaries. It's essential to express those thoughts and concepts clearly and concisely. Good writing is essential for almost any career. And with today's advanced technology, the National Commission on Writing reports that the need to write well has never been more important. Writing is everybody's business.
Sure, my neighbors Gene and Louise, they may be superheroes with superpowers, but that doesn't make them so super at saving energy and money.
Honey!
I may not be able to harness the power of the elements, but I save significant cash and help the environment with appliances, electronics, and windows featuring the Energy Star label. So discover your own energy-saving superpowers. Go to ASE.org/consumers.
Mom, Dad's making fun of you again.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. NAFTA is an issue for this election. Some people don't even know what it is. The North American Free Trade Agreement ends a lot of tariffs between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. It's not the only free trade agreement. There are others that we are considering signing, all the way from Chile in the south to Europe and the east. Now, people who support free trade will tell you it's the best way, that you have a comparative advantage, that those who make products better should be able to make those products and trade with other people. But what if we're competing with those that don't have the safety standards that we have, the environmental standards that we have? And what is this North American Competitiveness Council? Is our government actively working with corporations to hurt labor rights? We'll be hearing from Dr. Gabriela Lemus in just a few minutes. She is Executive Director of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. But I want to explore, just in your minds, this question, because it's going to be a major difference between John McCain and whichever nominee you have. Whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, I don't think we'll see much difference. But the charge is that actually Obama and Clinton are more supportive of free trade than they pretend to be. Bill Clinton, of course, passed NAFTA. The treaty was under his regime, if you will. And Hillary Clinton says she opposed it, but who knows? Who knows? Her biographers say that, in fact, she did oppose it during his time. As for Obama, Obama says that he wants to renegotiate NAFTA, but at the same time, his economic advisor is busy talking with the Canadians. So what's really going on here? Tim Russert demanded that both of them Obama and Clinton, that they give an immediate renegotiation. He said, are you going to demand that Canada and Mexico renegotiate the treaty? And they both said yes. They both said they would do that. They would have a renegotiation and would do so within the first 6 months. It's a pretty major pledge. And I don't know that either one of them really wants to keep it. Free trade does help some portions of the economy. Indeed, in Texas, it probably hurts. It probably helps more than it harms. That may not be the case in Ohio. So what is the issue here? How is it that we should protect our workers in ways that don't harm the economy? And should we have things like the North American Competitiveness Council that, in effect, helps certain corporations perhaps compete one with the other? To help answer these questions, I have invited Dr. Lemus, as I said. She's the Executive Director of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Dr. Lemus, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Now tell me, what is the North American Competitiveness Council?
The North American Competitiveness Council is a group of 30 corporate directors from Canada, 10 from Canada, 10 from the United States, 10 from Mexico, who are, for all intents and purposes, providing progress reports about the advancement of the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
Okay, well, let's go back. What is the Security and Prosperity Partnership?
NAFTA Plus, in short.
NAFTA Plus, NAFTA 2.0.
You could say, yeah.
Well, before we get to NAFTA 2.0, let's talk briefly about NAFTA 1.0. Okay, NAFTA was a treaty mm-hmm. that was brought forward in Bill Clinton's administration.
Correct.
And Does NAFTA wipe out all tariffs between Canada, Mexico, and the United States, or only
It has, at this point, pretty much wiped everything out. The most recent component that just got eliminated was the white corn and beans towards Mexico. And
so Mexico used to protect its white corn and beans mm-hmm. from competition.
And what's happened, though...
So now American farmers can sell to Mexico without a tariff.
Correct. But here's the deal. We have this thing called Farm Bill subsidies. So the United States actually subsidizes close to $384 billion versus Mexico, which is about 53, I think,
in Canada,
and
84. Is that legal under NAFTA, these farm subsidies?
It's a good question, and it's one that should be visited. You know, I think at the end of the day, though, a lot of what's being discussed right now is the concept of food security and what that means and food sovereignty, that there's certain crops that are vital to the survival of a nation.
If Mexico didn't have beans, they would be in big trouble.
Or corn.
Or corn.
Tortillas.
Yeah, that's true. Now NAFTA 2.0, security and
prosperity partnership.
What is that? And how does, if NAFTA 1.0 gets rid of most tariffs, what is the security and prosperity partnership?
Well, it's sort of phase two that actually begins to move away from the trade aspects and goes towards the security aspects. So essentially what you're looking at, this is being led by Chertoff from the Department of Homeland Security.
Michael Chertoff.
It's not so much being led by Secretary Gutierrez out of the Department of Commerce, which is kind of interesting. And the idea is to have a three-country border security process. So
this would protect, I guess, against terrorists crossing our border.
Narco traffickers, organized crime. Sure.
So the idea is, instead of building a wall, if you will, along the Rio Grande...
Oh, they're continuing to do that.
They're going to do that too, but the wall would be broader. It would include pretty much all of North America, you know.
Well, it would be stepping it up, or stepping it out, I guess it would be. And for instance, in southern Mexico, they've already begun implementing all kinds of sort of connected regions with Guatemala and Belize, for example.
Okay, but what's wrong with that? I mean, we don't want terrorists coming into our soil. We don't want drug traffickers either. What's wrong with making good security arrangements between our good allies, Canada and Mexico?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think the problem is in the process and the fact that there's no democratic principles to it. The only persons at the table are this North American Competitiveness Council. There is no civil society. There are no labor unions. There's very little public discussion. There's very little public discourse, and this is a very challenging road, I think, to go down, because we are not preparing the communities in any of the three countries. And inevitably, even though there's some indications that the numbers of immigrants are lowering, in large part because of change in demographics in Mexico, we are still seeing they want the free movement of goods and capital, but there is, you know, they stop at the issue of peoples moving back and forth,
now,
which
is
very challenging too.
Here you have something that is to protect security, and you know, I'm all for protecting American security, and why not Canadian and Mexican security too? There's nothing wrong with that. But here you would think they would have, I don't know, security firms there, or experts in terrorists, or experts in drug movement. Instead, what you're saying is that in addition to the three governments, the three mm-hmm. governments are working together on
mm-hmm.
this, right?
Correct.
You have 10 corporations of each nation.
Correct.
30 total corporations. And these corporations aren't necessarily involved in security. They're involved in selling...
Auto. You've got General Motors at the table. You've got the energy companies at the table. Because there's another component to this.
So what's
which
the other
is
component?
The regionalization of certain markets, specifically energy, utilities companies, water, privatization of water from Canada, for example, which carry with it great implications.
Well, let's be specific here. What, when you say the regionalization of water, what are you talking about?
Well, at this point in time, I think most countries, even though they have relationships and agreements about how they share water, which probably most people don't realize, now in privatizing the water, essentially it's taking away its sovereignty question per nation and the agreement cycle.
For example, the Colorado River, I know, has been one of the major water issues between the United States and Mexico. I assume the Rio Grande is too, but the one I know of mostly is the Colorado River, and the idea is, as much as farmers use it in the Southwest, which is, it's very important, it's in a desert. You know, have a river in a desert, water really matters. But the idea is that we have to give to Mexico the flow that would ordinarily be going, so
anyway,
that Mexico mm-hmm. gets its share, and that's a very old agreement. Privatization goes beyond that kind of thing?
Yes, because now we're looking also at sharing all these other sources. So, for example, the northern desert area of Mexico, which also requires water, the question is, will they be receiving their fair share? I mean, there's still things that are being negotiated that are very ancient, or I shouldn't say ancient.
Well, I guess my question is how these things, whether it's water, or I know between Canada and Mexico, there was an acid rain issue, environmental issues, these things
tend... No, actually, between the United States and Canada.
What did I say?
Mexico.
Sorry. Excuse me, yes, of course. It's between the United States and Canada, absolutely. But these issues tend to have been bilateral negotiations, maybe trilateral negotiations between the governments.
Right.
How are the corporations getting involved?
The corporations are basically setting the, establishing sort of the pathways about how would be the best case scenario for them. So essentially, and what's interesting too, when you look at the corporate partners, they're interrelated. Because a lot of the trade that's going on isn't so much U.S. manufacturing going to Mexico as it is a large multinational corporation going to its brothers and sisters up in Canada versus and its brothers and sisters. This is especially true in the automobile industry. And they're trading corporation to corporation.
So give me, let's talk about the auto industry since you raise it. You have, of course, the three major Detroit manufacturers, you know, Ford, GM, Chrysler, and they have subsidiaries in Mexico and in Canada.
Correct.
They're trying to protect their rights to trade without
I think
barriers.
What they're doing, is, in a way, yes, that's what's happening, but also, I mean, from their perspective, it's all about simplifying supply lines and getting maximum benefit for their what they're putting into
Doesn't
it to get improved
1.0
productivity.
Already do this? I mean,
it does, but it, this is facilitating it, making it even easier.
So specifically, what would it do?
Well, I think it would remove what few barriers are left.
Including security barriers, I guess. I mean, if
well,
you want to
actually,
get...
Well, no. What they need to do, too, and this is the part that I'm less clear on, but they have been trying to improve their ports. Earlier you mentioned Texas benefiting. Really what's benefiting in Texas is, for example, places like Laredo, which are a huge internal port of entry. They've actually become the smart border entry in the sense that it's actually quite fascinating to observe it. You know, the containers come in, they clear them,
facilitation. It's an electronic way. They don't have
it's
to open,
very electronic.
Open the
Well,
the
and that's
containers.
What they're trying to do is turn the border into a smart border. So you've got your biometric system for human beings, you've got, you know, all kinds of lasers and crazy things, tons and tons and tons of money being pumped into technology that hasn't proven to work.
Well, I mean, as an American concerned about security, that seemed to be in a good direction. How does this harm people, ordinary working people in Mexico or the United States?
I think part of the problem is that, you know, and this is the immigration issue, which is always a sensitive thing. Because people are not able to move so easily back and forth, well, they can move fairly easily from the United States into Mexico,
yeah,
which
sure
happens
that's
quite
true.
A
right.
bit.
Right.
And they can move, like, it's interesting to listen to the comparison of the projects. The Canada project is called the Peace Bridge. The project with Mexico is Operation Gatekeeper. So you've got
also
some
stay out. But yeah, that's
you've got some interesting contrasts.
The names in and of itself tells you who's welcome and who's not.
Right, or the Friendship Bridge. That's also a Canadian bridge.
Right.
And versus, you know, Operation whatever, Coyote, that they get.
It's because we have a lot of Mexicans who are emigrating to the United States.
We have a lot of Canadians emigrating, too, but nobody complains about Canadians.
No, tell me about this, because it's not something that most of us know about. What are the numbers of Canadian immigrants?
I don't have the exact numbers. I do know that there is a fairly free-moving border. It's very different going to the Mexican border versus going to the Canadian border, although the Canadian border has begun to become more strict, which I think people are, from a cultural perspective, it's very challenging. If you live in a border region, the people down in southern Texas, for example, are very upset about this wall that they're trying to put in. They don't want it. That's not how their communities operate. And you have to remember...
Because they have a free flow of people and goods across.
And, you know, you make it up in the morning and you go, you do your grocery shopping on one side, you work on the other side you live, and you go back and forth on a daily basis.
The people of Laredo and Nueva Laredo know each other and shop in each other's
They
towns.
Are family, probably. I mean, to a certain
Yeah, actually,
but
Laredo
it's all
is mostly Latino Americans anyway.
Or El Paso, same thing with Juarez. Or even less so the San Diego-Tijuana nexus. Maybe if you looked at Chula Vista, it would be more like that. All along the border, these communities have always just intertwined, and the same thing, especially in southern Arizona.
So tell me specifically what where we began this. The North American Competitiveness Council. 30 corporations, 10 from each of these countries, mm-hmm. sitting on this security partnership, NAFTA 2.0, mm-hmm. that's supposed to be about security, and they are there to influence, I guess, to make sure that their corporate interests are protected.
Yes.
And labor groups are not invited.
No.
Now, who made this decision? Michael Chertoff? I mean,
no, Michael Chertoff would not. But the meeting, for example, on April 22nd, they have scheduled. They just had one in Cabo San Lucas. Now they're going to have one in New Orleans. And the president announced this during his State of the Union address. And I believe it's going to be held on April 22nd. And essentially, you're going to see the three executives come in and talk. I think we need to be concerned is, again, this. We are moving towards coordination. As opposed to cooperation. These agreements...
Coordination as opposed to cooperation.
Meaning there's going to be, in order for this to work the way they're planning, there are going to have to be entities created that are trinational. A lot of people...
Well, that concerns you.
Well, I think it needs to be done in a way that people understand that you're not taking away from sovereignty questions. And that is not how it looks on the surface.
Now, this is very interesting to me because it sounds to me like you and, you know, you're with the Council for Labor Advancement sort of taking from the workers' position. And I look at someone who's very anti-immigrant, someone like Lou Dobbs, who's mm-hmm. very much opposed to many of the things that you agree with. And yet on this issue,
we're similar. Yeah.
You both would have a similar view. You'd support
probably
sovereignty.
Probably for different reasons.
I mean, that's so interesting to me, because I think that you and Lou Dobbs probably couldn't be more different on the immigration question. And yet he would also be concerned of a trilateral entity that would violate, in his case, U.S. sovereignty.
Right. All three countries would start giving up certain sovereignty questions. It's inevitable.
It would be like the European Union. Is that where we're going?
I don't think so. I think there's been a lot of discussion about that model. They have 50 years of working towards this and in a very different situation in that they've had this huge, you know, history of war.
We need to take a break, but I want to encourage you folks to call in. Anything to do with trade? What do you think of the idea of a European Union, if you will, a North American Union between Canada, Mexico, and the United States? Would you be willing to give up a little bit of sovereignty to help the free flow of goods and people? Let us know. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back after this.
One day, I forgot to throw away my trash after lunch, but then I saw it later when I was playing in the woods. The next week, I went boating with my grandpa, and there it was. I tried to go swimming, but I couldn't because of my trash. And when I went fishing, well, you can guess what I caught that day. So now I always throw in my trash in the garbage can, where it belongs.
One in eight Americans goes hungry. One idea helped change that. A community started a garden that blossomed into farmers markets. One in six children lives in poverty. One group of women found an answer by opening a daycare center that their neighbors could afford. Today, 36 million Americans live in poverty. But one by one, people are helping themselves and each other to change the picture of poverty to one of hope. For easy ways you can help, visit PovertyUSA.org.
Every year, 250,000 Americans are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
My fellow scientists and I are working on treatments and a cure for this deadly disease.
Millions of lives are at stake. Alzheimer's disease affects one in three families.
We're committed to uncovering the mystery of Alzheimer's.
And we're not going to quit until the job is done.
To find out more about Alzheimer's disease, call 1-800-437-2423.
Only through research will a cure be found.
James, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not a helmet.
Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're talking about NAFTA 2.0. NAFTA 1.0, of course, is the North American Free Trade Agreement. This is the security
partnership. I want to get the name right.
Prosperity Partnership.
Security Prosperity Partnership. It's a way to protect the security of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. But what's interesting is you've got 30 corporations involved, no labor voice, no environmental voice either. My guest is Dr. Gabriela Lemus. She's the Executive Director of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Dr. Lemus, what is the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement?
We are a constituency group. We represent approximately 1.8 million Latino trade unionists throughout the United States, Puerto Rico. We're celebrating our 35th anniversary this year.
And you said United States and Puerto Rico. You don't represent Mexican trade unionists?
No, although we do have very close connections with not just Mexican trade unionists and Canadian trade unionists, but all the way down to the Tierra del Fuego, all the way down to the southern
tip of South America.
Absolutely.
Now, you say Latin American advancement. What do you want to advance? Is this labor rights, safety issues?
It is part of that.
Wages? Is it a typical AFL-CIO type labor agenda, or is it different?
It is, but it is slightly nuanced because we are looking at the relationships that we have with our former countries of origin, as well as with the Latino workers who are here, who are either immigrant or native born, doesn't really matter. It's very much international in that sense, even though we represent domestic interest.
Well, let me ask you internationally, because a lot of the complaint of American workers and many Latino American workers, more the citizens, I think, than the undocumented immigrants, is that, let's face it, the wage disparity between Mexico and the United States is great. There's
it's
just
huge.
No way around it. It's a fact, and the reason why so many Mexicans are trying to come to America and work here is because there are better wages. There's better opportunities here. Unless and until Mexico increases its wages, treats its workers better, arrives at something close to parity, there's always going to be this problem. You're going to have Mexicans coming into America and actually depressing wages here. Is that fair?
I think that there's a lot of different data on that, and this is one of those deals where, you know, the data can depending on what region, what sector, et cetera. I do think that one of the points you just made is critical, and it is the fact that Mexico, when it was invited to participate in this trade agreement, had to agree to certain things. It could not change its minimum wage. It had to get rid of its Social Security. It needed to eliminate pension funds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You're talking about the original NAFTA now.
The original NAFTA. But what happens? Those rules stayed in place. They had to alter their constitution. They had to do
so they didn't follow through on their part of the agreement?
Oh, they did, very much so. Much more quickly than the United States did.
So they did increase their minimum wage?
No, they're not supposed to increase.
Oh, they're not supposed to increase
so
their
minimum wage.
This is interesting to me. NAFTA is supposed to make it more fair for American workers to compete, isn't it? I would think that you'd have to raise Mexican wages in order to make it more fair for Americans to compete.
That's correct. You would want to theoretically raise Mexican wages, but in effect what happened, they destroyed the Mexican countryside. So agriculture was, the ag part in particular, was so inexpensive.
They, you mean NAFTA?
Yes, the way the treaty was written. So now you have the displacement of some 3 million workers from the Mexican countryside.
Well, let me explore that, because I think it's important to know the mechanisms. How did NAFTA destroy Mexican agriculture?
Well, it wasn't supposed to, but with the changes in the tariffs, for example, Mexican or U.S. corn and other agro products could now enter into Mexico. And you also saw major corporations like Tyson's, for example, or Cargill, come in and buy into Mexican ag industry, which was very...
Maybe America has a competitive advantage. I mean,
it definitely
Mexico has a competitive
did.
Advantage on cheap labor and other things, and sugar. America may have a competitive advantage on corn. Isn't that what economics is supposed to be? If we make corn cheaper and Mexico makes sugar cheaper?
But the United States subsidizes its agriculture to a much greater extent than the Mexicans are even able to. And the system as it was before wasn't prepared for that kind of ag industry to come in. It was mostly subsistence and small farmers and a tradition that comes out of the Mexican Revolution, which sounds primitive at this point, but essentially they're co-ops.
Now, your organization, did it exist when NAFTA became a treaty? And I take it that your group opposed NAFTA.
They did, absolutely.
On the grounds that it hurt both Americans and Mexicans.
We felt strongly that it would hurt on the basis of there was no clear, the labor agreements were side agreements, so there was no clear way of actually enforcing them because they're side agreements.
And they have not been enforced, these side agreements?
Very limitedly, and generally the corporations get to win.
Well, what are some of those side agreements, and how
there's
would they enforce
there's
them?
There's two. There's labor side agreement, and there's the environmental side agreements. And essentially, that's, you know, the environmental are more easily understood, and that it's issues of dumping and pollution and all these kinds of things. And you have to remember, especially in border regions are their own regions. They don't really observe borders. Border regions are ecosystems that, you know, survive on both sides.
Sure.
With regards to people, then it gets a little trickier. So you have certain companies that may not have behaved so well in the Mexican side. For example, these are cases that I'm aware of, where the workers want to demand their rights and have basically not really been able to do that.
But can workers unionize in Mexico?
They can,
but
it's
Mexico,
very
I think
challenging.
A much more left-leaning government, certainly, than the United States of America, right? No.
Not anymore, no. The PAN, which is in charge now, the Partido de Acción Nacional, is actually a right-wing party. And it's very much, it comes from northern Mexico, and they are much more, I would say they're more akin to the Republican Party than to the left.
Might this change? When is the next Mexican election?
Oh, they've got a while. Their elections are every
six years. Right.
Yes,
yeah,
so I think we're looking at 2010, no, I think.
What about Canada? I mean, Canada certainly is a country that is more left, more socialist than the United States. I would think their workers would demand a strong say.
Their workers have had a stronger, a better ability to have some input, but they've lost a lot. And what's really interesting is that in all three countries, productivity has risen exponentially. And yet real wages in all three countries have dropped by 30%.
So basically, workers are working better, but the profits are all going to people at the top. They're not going down to the
corporate mentality is really looking at the investors and at the shareholders and at the profit margins, not so much at the market nor at their workers.
But here's my question. Corporations not looking out for workers, that's as old as corporations. That goes back, you know, 100 years, we can talk about the great strikes 100 years ago in Eugene
1880s.
B. Debs and the 1880s, exactly, the whole progressive era.
Riots.
It doesn't surprise me that corporations want to mistreat workers and make a lot of money for their CEOs, whether it be in Mexico, the United States, or Canada. That is an issue that all three governments, all three peoples can work and try to stop. But NAFTA, in and of itself, shouldn't be about how corporations treat their workers. That's something that's regulated by each of the nation's governments. It merely allows trade between them. How do you deal with the argument that NAFTA is not designed to help or harm workers? It simply helps trade, and that your issue, which is mistreatment of workers, is a separate issue, an issue that we need more labor rights and so forth.
I think what you've got here is a situation whereby when they sold NAFTA to the people, they sold it as a method to reduce immigration, to increase the well-being of workers, and to create development in lesser developed countries, i.e. in this case Mexico. It's the model that's been used for all trade agreements. With regards to a corporation coming into an area, part of the problem, too, with the Mexican situation is that, indeed, the system is not as well working as it should be. You still have essentially oligarchical elites that were allowed to, when the privatization piece goes into effect, which was also a big part of NAFTA, in order to allow NAFTA to happen, you have 24 families, essentially, that take over the Mexican economy for all intensive purposes. The second richest man in the world is Carlos Slim, who essentially has a monopoly over telephony in Mexico.
Weren't 24 families in charge before NAFTA?
No. These are new families. You went from having maybe one or two billionaires to now having many. I mean, a handful still, comparatively speaking. Excuse me.
How did NAFTA help oligarchs control the Mexican economy?
It was a collusion, I'm afraid, between the political system and the elite. And I think
the elite pays off the politicians. The politicians deliver.
They need campaign reform in Mexico now, which never had happened before. It's quite unique. Same conversations we have here, they're having down there, because the media is controlled by one family, et cetera. So different media are controlled by different family groups
now,
and different corporations.
Both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton have said that they would renegotiate NAFTA. They both said it in the recent debate. There's some argument over whether they really mean it or not, and
sure,
there's some
Canada.
Questions about that. You know, of course, about Austin Goolsbee.
NAFTAgate.
Yes, NAFTAgate, Obama's advisor talking with the Canadians.
And Clinton, too.
What, in your view, should be renegotiated in NAFTA, and what should be left alone as the idea of free trade generally being a good thing?
Well, I think part of the problem is we need to evaluate. Not enough evaluation has taken place as to where we've actually seen dislocation of workers. I mean, it's very alarming when you see the hundreds and thousands of jobs that have been lost, at least in the last, I mean, it's been going on, but in the last 8 years.
In all three countries?
In all three countries, but also in the United States. I mean, I think it's mind-boggling. I think we've lost 20% of our manufacturing sector. And this is the correlation with globalization, because trade agreements are part of a bigger process. And the globalization component is about competitiveness at the end of the day.
Now, isn't globalization something that is just going to happen anyway? I mean, you know, we don't have blacksmiths
well, you can
anymore.
Have chaos.
We have cars rather than horses. Our world becomes more interconnected with technology and internet and trade.
It can be managed.
Okay, how would you manage globalization?
I think this is where the NAFTA was supposed to go originally, which was to have regional types of controls but caveat is be prepared for this, and this is what we're not doing. We're not preparing for this.
Well, what controls are necessary?
I think, for example, the labor and the environmental side agreements should be core components of the trade agreement. Now, if we're going to move towards a security and prosperity partnership or NAFTA plus, then clearly they've already set those groundworks up, whether, you know, it's creating roads
and
transportation. And the fact
that they're not core means that they're generally honored in the breach. You're saying people just
they
aren't following them.
Don't necessarily get followed, no. There's no real oversight.
Well, what is the enforcement mechanism, both for regular NAFTA and for these side agreements?
Well, the side agreements, essentially you can go to the WTO if there's some gross...
The World Trade Organization.
The World Trade Organization. If there's some gross violation, there's corporations that, that's usually from the corporate angle. From what do you do with people, though? What do you do with communities? Keep going.
Tell you what the music said. Let's take a little break.
Okay.
I want to give our listeners a chance to call in and be heard as well. It's easy to do. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. You can also comment on the blog. A lot of you would rather write your comments down. That's okay. Just go to RadioInsideScoop.com and ask a tough question. It's fine. My guests can handle it, I'm sure. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Live from Washington, it's the Inside...
One day, I forgot to throw away my trash after lunch. But then
don't
I
do
saw
that again.
Bear when I was playing in the woods. The next week, I went boating with my grandpa, and there it was. I tried to go swimming, but I couldn't because of my trash. And when I went fishing, well, you can guess what I caught that day. So now I always throw away my trash in the garbage can, where it belongs.
1 in 8 Americans goes hungry. One idea helped change that. A community started a garden that blossomed into farmers markets. 1 in 6 children lives in poverty. One group of women found an answer by opening a daycare center that their neighbors could afford. Today, 36 million Americans live in poverty. But one by one, people are helping themselves and each other to change the picture of poverty to one of hope. For easy ways you can help, visit povertyusa.org.
Every year, 250,000 Americans are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
My fellow scientists and I are working on treatments and a cure for this deadly disease.
Millions of lives are at stake. Alzheimer's disease affects 1 in 3 families.
We're committed to uncovering the mystery of Alzheimer's.
And we're not going to quit until the job is done.
To find out more about Alzheimer's disease, call 1-800-437-2423.
Only through research will a cure be found.
James, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not a helmet.
Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi,
I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important
piece
of equipment.
Well, my analogy.
That's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Ross Perot, 15 years ago, talked about the giant sucking sound. The giant sucking sound of corporations sinking, I guess, south of the border and going to get the cheap labor of Mexico. Then came NAFTA, which was supposed to help workers of all three countries. Instead, we see increased globalization. But globalization necessarily shouldn't have to be a bad thing. The idea that we trade with people of different cultures, we trade with different societies, and have competitive advantage over different products, in and of itself shouldn't be a problem if managed correctly. Mm. To address that issue is Dr. Gabriel Lemus, the Executive Director of Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Dr. Lemus, managing globalization. That's a hard word to say.
Globalization. No, no cessation. Just lization.
Oh, globalization.
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 There you go.
It's hard enough. It's hurting workers, yeah, and now I can't say the word. How do you manage this in a way that doesn't end up leading to basically closed societies where everyone has their own tariff barriers and people just protect their own native products?
Well, I think, first off, we need to really look at the impact that this trade agreement specifically and what globalization has done to small and medium-sized manufacturers, for example, which have traditionally been the backbone of the economies. Because one thing is to have these large transnationals, which really aren't glued to their local market in comparison to a smaller, medium-sized business, which is more so.
So the transnational is much more likely to say, sorry, we're going to fire 500 workers and lose this factory town and move to Tijuana than someone who is more based in the community.
Right, because obviously if you're a smaller, medium-sized manufacturer, you don't have that kind of capital to simply pick up and go. You don't have those, what we talked about earlier, competitive advantages that you can play with and manipulate, because it's all one big market to you. Whereas to the small and medium-sized business, your market is probably that transnational corporation. So certain transnationals are conscientious or conscious, and they will actually create diversity programs here in the United States, for example. I don't know much about Canada's situation. I know in Mexico that doesn't happen.
Well, let's talk about Mexico, because if you have a corporation that's making cars, and there's a certain labor cost, and of course you have the auto workers, and they protect their workers, and they make sure they have health care, and if they are injured on the job, they get protection and doctor's benefits and so forth. If an auto company moves to Mexico where wages are cheaper and the workers don't have to get health care, for the corporation, they get cheaper cars.
That's right. Well, you have to remember also that the minimum wage in Mexico is $4.54 a day.
A day?
A day.
$4.54
a day.
A day.
And their basket for consumer goods is probably, you know, you're looking at milk, tortillas, beans, rice. You're looking at probably $40 to $50 a week.
Now, is Mexico doing better? Are their wages going up?
No.
I mean, there's such a huge disparity. They're not even getting closer.
No, there is a shrinking middle class. Sounds familiar. There's a shrinking middle class. There is this group of very, 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 very wealthy who are doing very well. And then,
so why isn't there a revolution in Mexico? I mean,
well, they already had one, and it didn't go so well. It was very bloody and violent.
You're talking about 70 years ago or so.
I know, but revolutions are they're still in the memory of the people. They don't just walk away that simply. And I think you have.
I mean, if Cardenas were to become the president, would there be major changes?
It's hard to say because of the infrastructure itself. I should say, not the infrastructure, the structural system.
The political infrastructure.
That's right. It is so calcified. I don't know what it would take. There was belief that when President Fox came in, that was an opportunity to really begin to change and shift. And he had trouble because now you actually have a Congress that works like a Congress. So now there were restraints placed on the executive that had never existed before. So now they were finding their ways, how they were going to behave as legislators. Let's just say that if you have a gridlock here in Washington, D.C., you can imagine what it was like in Mexico. The Mexican president is not allowed to travel without the Congress's permission.
Wow.
So,
but here we have Mexican workers that are doing pretty lousy. We have American workers who have to compete with these Mexican workers who are doing worse off. What can possibly be done to help both the Mexican workers and the American workers and not make them enemies?
Sure.
How do we make them allies?
Well, there's far more in common than there is not. So, and that's part of what we need to ensure that people understand. And I do think perhaps using the trade agreement, since it's already there as a model, I mean, I don't think we can just scrap the thing. I don't know that we can fix it either, because it's unclear what it's doing wrong, except for
the fact...
You're
talking about the original NAFTA now.
The original NAFTA. The one thing we do know about the original NAFTA is that millions of workers were displaced in Mexico, and the United States had a market that was growing, and that, you know, baby boomers retiring, and there was an outreach to these workers. There are contractors who go down to Mexico on a regular basis looking for workers and bringing them up, not so legally necessarily, promising visas and then not delivering and keeping these people in very exploited conditions. Those are the kinds of things we need to fight against.
And that's something that you, again, you and Lou Dobbs could agree on, punishing the employers for taking workers from Mexico, paying them substandard wages, which harms American workers and also harms the Mexican workers who are getting substandard wages.
The issue is, though, that the law doesn't really go after the contractors. It doesn't really go after the employers. It looks at the contractors. The contractors are the ones that need to know what's really going on. And they disappear. I mean, I've had many a situation where contractors have brought in 200-300 workers into a small work site in, let's say, Memphis, Tennessee, and then just decided to cross the border, take the money, and run.
Given the real systemic problems in Mexico, though, won't we always have this problem? I want to be with us for decades.
Well, yes, we are going to have a problem. It will continue. I think, though, that given its influence, the United States and Canada could influence most of the models, for example, around the environment are coming out of the bilateral relationship between Canada and the United States. Then they're being taken down to Mexico, and Mexico is being told, okay, this is what we want, which may or may not work because they're not prepared. They don't have that kind of infrastructure. And trust me, there is a serious environmental problem in Mexico on many, many, many levels.
So if labor groups were invited into the Security and Prosperity Partnership, what could you do to affect NAFTA 2.0? That you couldn't do in NAFTA 1.0 to really stem some of these negative
influences? Well, one, raise consciousness about this job loss situation. I mean, it's serious. We, you know, I think 12% of our GDP comes from manufacturing, which used to be just, again, in the last 8 years, it went down from 16 to 12, and it keeps steadily declining. And then, you know, looking at relationships, for example, between the federal government in the case of the United States and corporations and contracts that they hand out. That are causing, they're not necessarily related to NAFTA, but it's part of the same mentality and you know, that...
Well, what do we need? Do we need more tariffs? Do we need more taxing of corporations that go abroad? I mean, one of the things I find interesting is that if a corporation moves abroad, sometimes they save on American taxes instead of owing more American taxes.
That's correct.
They fire a bunch of workers, they go abroad, and at the same time they get benefits.
Well, actually, the United States taxpayer pays between $8 and $9 billion annually to outsource.
The taxpayer.
Yeah, and tax credits.
We give tax credits for outsourcing,
mm-hmm.
Not just people paying less taxes. Actually,
mm-hmm.
giving credits.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I'm trying to understand the justification.
So
the taxpayer is subsidizing the loss of their own jobs.
And to a certain extent, yes. At least that's the data I got from the Economic Policy Institute. When I saw the number, I was rather shocked. But it's the way the system works, or at least the way they've set it up.
So this isn't free trade. This is pro-corporate trade.
Yes.
I mean, this isn't a question of capitalism letting everyone rise or fall as they may. The government is actually helping the corporations fire American workers.
Well, they are allowing them to be as competitive as they want to be at the expense of American workers. So meaning that the transnational, you got to remember, this is a money game. This is all about major, major, major dollars that are going back and forth and moving very freely. And some of the biggest companies that are completely entrenched in this concept are the finance companies.
The finance companies.
Yes.
Banks.
Absolutely. And
brokerage
again.
Companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're making a lot of money. I mean, on this hedge funds and all these you know, investments, etc.
So now, do you support more tariffs? Do you think we should be?
I don't know that that's the answer either. Actually, in reality, U.S. companies pay very high taxes, comparatively speaking, with other industrialized nations, for example.
Compared to Europe or compared to Mexico and Canada?
Well, compared to Europe, at least. I'm sure they pay way more than the companies in Mexico. I know I don't want to pick on poor Mr. Carlos Slim, but my understanding is he does not pay much in the way of taxes. Yet he's the second richest man in the world.
So it's not necessarily tariffs that
now,
you
want. Now, the corporations in Mexico do get taxed pretty heavily.
But Mr. Mm-hmm. Carlos Slim apparently can pay off certain political officials
and
therefore avoid his tax. I mean, isn't that...
I'm not sure
fair.
That that's
isn't
really
that how
how
Mexican
works.
Politics works? If you're very rich, you can give some money to a government official and...
I don't think that it's that clear anymore. I think it's changed. I think it's become a whole new level of I think it's become, actually, frankly, far more similar to how we have K Street and Wall Street. It's starting to look more like that model in Mexico, which was never the case before. And because they don't have any reform for the electoral side of it.
We only have a couple minutes left.
Okay.
Tell me specifically what you and your organization advocate in terms of NAFTA 2.0, in terms of trade, immigration. What are you trying to get?
I think the most important thing is that we understand that there is a connection between globalization, trade, and immigration. And that we examine what our economic policies are. If we're truly interested in reducing immigration, then we need to examine what our economic policies are to ensure that that gets addressed. Second, I think it's critical that we do a sectoral by sectoral analysis and possibly even state by state in all three countries to see how the relationship is actually working, because I don't think people understand. It's hard enough to put your arms around something like globalization, for example. It's just as hard to do it in the case of this trade policy. The other issue I think that's critical is that at the very least that we push for the labor side agreements and the environmental side agreements to be a core part of the actual trade agreement so that it can be enforced better. They can be enforced better.
I don't know
better.
If you've made an endorsement, but do you think that Obama's or Clinton's proposals are significantly different with regard to these subjects?
I don't think they've thought it through all the way
yet. Neither one of them.
Neither one of them. I think this question came up sort of unexpectedly for them. We don't endorse candidates. We're not allowed to do that.
But both of them would be better than McCain on these issues.
McCain definitely has a very pro-trade slant.
Pro-trade meaning?
Pro-NAFTA.
Pro-NAFTA.
It's benefited to Arizona.
It's benefited Arizona while harming these other workers. We could go on and on about this subject. Thank you for coming
My
and
pleasure.
For sharing your erudition with us. Your website is GL...
No, www.lclaa.org.
lclaa.org. I want to get that right.
www.lclaa.org.
It's under construction. If you want to comment on today's show, it's easy to do. Go to RadioInsideScoop.com and put your comments on the line. This is Mark Levine, signing off.